This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. We live in a digital world, and all kinds of conundrums, large and small, arise that no one could have anticipated 20 years ago. On the small side, how to express tone in a text message or email. You might think you're being breezy, but the recipient thinks you're being brusque. Your cell phone rings while you're in line at the coffee shop. It's a call you need to take, but you're almost up to order. Take the call or let it go to voicemail and deal face-to-face with the cashier. In my family, my mother and my stepfather have no home phone, so when I call them, I have to choose one cell phone or the other. And although they've never expressed any kind of affront, I'm careful to alternate numbers so I don't risk suggesting favoritism. And then there are the bigger ones. What should we do about the number of people texting or checking email while driving? And what are the privacy implications of advances like Google Glass, where people will be able to walk into a locker room, museum, office place, with, I guess, fairly unobtrusive glasses on their heads that can take pictures and videos? Vegas casinos are getting ahead of that game and preemptively banning the device. But this is surely the first skirmish in a larger war. Today on the program, we're going to talk about digital manners and how we govern our own and others' behavior in public places. And we'll explore some of the generational differences that can lead to crossed wires and ruffled feathers. We're joined today by Daniel Post-Senning from the Emily Post Institute in Burlington. He's the author of the Institute's latest etiquette book, Manners in a Digital World. Dan, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Hi, Jane. It's good to be with you.
So let's tackle a couple of those questions, the ones that seem to arise all of the time. So First of all, cell phones at the family dinner table. Do it, don't do it.
You know, there are very few nevers in life. This is one of those. I think it's a never. It's a no-no. Step aside. Excuse yourself from the table to take that important call.
But what about, you know, if you have teenagers? They often want to be on their digital devices. It can be hard to get them off. So, fine, dinner table, maybe that's a no-no. And we did get people emailing in before the show saying, who would have cell phones at the dinner table? Oh, my God. So, fine, we'll take dinner table out of the context. But what about, you know, when you're hanging around with your kids? How do you set rules for when they can have them, when they can't? I mean, it might have been easier 20 years ago when there was one family phone line and you could say you're on it for an hour and then you're off.
Well, you would think so. At the same time, when that first phone came to the home, there were a lot of concerns. Was it going to be the end of family life? Was that the end of the family dinner? And sure enough, over time, we figured out how to navigate that intrusion into our private lives. And this is a new wave of this intrusion. We have a next generation technology to deal with. And we're definitely in that new territory right now, while the absolute standards are still shaking out. Makes it kind of an exciting time, kind of an interesting time, but it doesn't necessarily mean that everything that came before is going to disappear.
So what do you say, confiscate phones? I mean, there are a lot of parents who say, look, my teenagers, if they have a device in their hands, they're looking down at it, I can't get them to concentrate on me. So what do? Take it away?
So the best parenting advice, and this comes from my mother, is to always be the parent that you want your children to be. So model the behavior you'd like to see. And in this case, establishing a healthy digital diet, an ability to move from one means of communication to another as is appropriate. So the dinner table, there is no place for the phone in the table setting. That's a place where it's face-to-face. That's the appropriate type of communication. It's important to keep that in the diet. At the same time, a lot of parents are finding that texting with their teens is a great way to enter their world, to meet them in their space, the place they're comfortable in, the medium that they converse in. It's opening up a dialogue between parents and teens that can be really valuable. And it's important to meet them in that space, too. So you want the healthy digital diet from the text and the facility with texting to a good face-to-face conversation.
I'm really sorry to embarrass my mother again here. So my mother has embraced texting with her children, except she has also embraced emoticons and text speak. So there's a lot of numbers and abbreviated words and, you know, what spelled W-A-T and you spelled just you.
And it feels a little dated.
Well, yeah. I mean, she's thinking, hey, I'm hip with the young generation. Uh-huh. My 30-year-old brother won't respond. I mean, if she writes anything that is not proper grammar, he will not even respond. So how do you know that you're embracing young people's technology without being way, way wrong?
Well, when you're an early adopter or when you're new, you maybe converse in other mediums. You figure out what the expectations are. You watch behaviors and you're a little careful at first as you figure out what the expectations are, both for a medium and for a relationship. One of the real rubrics is look at the relationship that's being served. And how is that relationship being served? The phone itself isn't rude or polite. The text itself isn't rude or polite. It's really how we use it that matters. So for the brother that needs complete sentences, good sentence structure, I'm going to do that. I'm going to honor that. For the texting shorthand, it's funny. Shorthand is often a great way for older generations. We've been doing this forever. We all have ways that we shorten and reduce and invent language to make discourse easier. So in many ways, text speak is a new shorthand, but you don't write the memo to your boss in the shorthand you took notes in the meeting. So again, you've got to be able to adjust and move between these different styles where appropriate.
We're talking today about digital manners, how we govern our own behaviors, how we govern other people's behavior in public places. And we are also exploring some of the generational differences that can lead to crossed wires and sometimes ruffled feathers. And listeners, I know so many of you have experience with this, from setting limits at the family dinner table when it comes to texting and checking email, to wondering how to tell a coworker you think it's rude that he keeps looking at his phone during staff meetings. You can give us your solutions or just vent your frustrations. That's okay, too. You can give us a call at 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or, of course, since this is the topic, go ahead, go digital. Post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. And we're talking here about all of these digital manners. Let's talk about that office etiquette. I want to put VPR staffers on notice here, because we actually got this note from our program director, Franny Bastian, who said, one thing that really bugs me is that more and more people are sitting at meetings with their phone front and center on the table. I always want to ask, is that really necessary? Do we all have to know that you have a message when your phone vibrates? I wish people would keep their phones in their pockets, and I'd be really interested to know what the expert says.
Well, the expert is going to support your producer in this case. It's so important to give our attention to the people that we're actually with. Think about the boss who comes to a meeting. Someone's been working on a proposal, very hard work for a week or more, and they sit there checking email throughout the entire time. What message does that send? It sends that I'm disengaged, I don't care, I'm not interested. Even if that's not what they intend, it's really about the perception of the other person. I'm perfectly capable. I can check this email real quick and get it out and bring my attention back to you in 10 seconds, 15 seconds. This might feel like a normal thought, an excuse that you give yourself, but that other person, they've really got a situation where they're...
Sorry, Daniel. I just have to take this. I'm really sorry.
Son of a gun. Phone just went off in the studio.
So hang on just one second. Hey,
it's so
sweetheart.
Distracting. What are we going to do
with
this situation?
If you could just pick up the dog after it, take him for a walk. And I think, chicken sounds great for dinner. Yeah, okay.
It's the classic example of program behavior. We all know about Pavlov's dog. You ring a bell, you feed a dog, you measure its salivary response. Pretty soon, you don't need to feed the dog, and he automatically responds.
So I shouldn't have just taken that phone call?
The example that we all know of program behavior is responding to a bell. The ability to silence the phone, put it away, or even leave it behind, I know, is a really fundamental skill to managing your device today and having control of it. Otherwise, it will control you. It's almost impossible not to respond to that ring.
So at an office situation, in a situation like you and I are in right now, maybe just don't even bring the phone or turn it off, put it somewhere.
Religious services. A first date. I can think of lots of times where there's just no reason to take your attention elsewhere.
But on a first date, wouldn't you want to have your phone there in case the date says, I can't make it? I mean, you don't want those kinds of cross wires.
Or maybe it's the safety call that comes an hour in to give you an excuse
right.
to leave. There is some new territory. At the same time, you do want to think about what you're communicating. And if that first date matters to you, if you really want to send the message that this person's important to me, leave your phone in your pocket.
We got an email from Eric who says many real families are squandering mealtime opportunity to be conversant with each other and instead being social with their screen devices. Mm. Perhaps it's time to turn the counterculture phrase on its head and turn off, tune out, and drop in.
I love the play on words.
Yeah. Nicholas wrote, from what I've seen, it's okay to use a phone while driving, eating, meeting with friends, and at the movie theater. It would seem no one can live without their phones these days. I sense a little...
Well, and that's what we're talking about, is removing that automated response. And we have a saying at the Emily Post Institute, we say safety trumps etiquette. And this is a case where it absolutely does. In the car, don't be tinkering with your navigation system. Set it ahead of time. A great piece of digital etiquette, if you're a passenger, offer to help with that digital device, with the radio, with the navigation.
All right. But then there's a question. If you see someone texting while driving, what do you do? I mean, obviously, this is something that many, many people are concerned about. Certainly, mm-hmm. the laws in many states, Vermont included, say you cannot text while driving. But it's also the one that we've seen in surveys that people say don't do it and then they do it. So how do we change that?
Absolutely. And, you know, it always starts with me. It's so much easier to see rudeness in other people than it is to see it in myself. We know this statistically, and we know it experientially at the Emily Post Institute. This is a case where a little self-reflection is really important for everybody involved. It's also true that something like 60% of youth have witnessed their parents using their device at the dinner table, at a movie or concert, or while driving. The absolute standards aren't shaken out. We don't have people that we can necessarily look to that are modeling the behavior. It's really on each of us. And that's a challenge. We often say the test of good etiquette is how you deal with the rude. And you rarely have standing to address it. So the screaming in your car, laying on your horn, rude gestures aren't the solution. In fact, they're probably going to exacerbate the situation, contribute to road rage, contribute to that lack of attention to what's important, which is driving. So look for someone who has standing to address the situation. If it's someone you know, maybe talk to them when they're not driving, when it's not occurring. If it is your parent and you're concerned about it and you want to talk to them, have that discussion when it's not going on. And contexted in the concern for their safety and their well-being.
You reminded me of something that I want to go back to that I got so distracted when I took that phone call. I forgot
to
ask you.
It happens to all of us.
So if there's something at work, should you approach your coworker and say, you know, it really bugged me that you had your phone on the table during that meeting because it kept vibrating? Or is that something you go to your supervisor about?
I like to call this the broccoli on the tooth rule. If you can help someone avoid embarrassment by raising an awkward or difficult situation, most people would rather that you did. Something like 80% of people would rather be approached by a colleague or a coworker than a supervisor or someone from HR. If you're not comfortable having that discussion, you can talk to someone who has standing. If you're going to talk to a coworker, again, do it in private. Your intent is to help them, not to embarrass them or make them feel awkward. An opening statement like, if it were me, I'd want someone to talk to me or tell me about it. I'm concerned about how you're being perceived, and I'm assuming that you wouldn't want to be seen this way, as if you're distracted or you're taking a lot of personal calls at work. I'd want someone to talk to me about it if that was the perception of me professionally.
Or, of course, you could always just send an email to this show and we'll read it publicly, and now everybody knows.
The illusion of anonymity.
That's right. Listeners, if you have a question, you can post it on our Facebook page or call 1-800-639-2211. Trisha's on the line with us from Westminster. Hi, Trisha. Go right ahead.
Hello. I just wanted to make a comment. I'm 22 years old, and I work as a cashier at my co-op, and it provides a great perspective on society. I mainly see that it's predominantly the older generations who have the least etiquette with their cell phones. I have never owned a cell phone, and I like it that way. But I notice that teenagers, if they have their cell phones in the store, they'll take it outside or they'll go in a private corner, whereas a lot of middle-aged, especially women, will just cash out at the register talking on the phone, and it is so impolite, and it's so hard to deal with.
Trisha, thanks for the call. Sounds like you have some experience with that. What about it, Dan?
I'm going to second that. Thanks, Trisha. It's so much fun for me to hear a digital native, as some people are now referring to your generation, the people that have grown up with these devices and this communication technology, talking about the lack of manners that they're seeing in the older generations. It flips on the head the question that we often get at the Emily Post Institute, which is such a treat. And I do think that you're noticing something about the current environment, which is for many people in the older generations, they're just now adopting these technologies. They didn't grow up as conversant in the medium, the communication medium of texting, instant messaging, use of cell phones. The situation, the particular situation that you described, the checkout line, is the locus of some of the most rude behavior that occurs with the cell phone. And that's talking on your phone when you're with a captive audience. And for me, the prime example of a captive audience is the person who's checking you out. That's that person's job. They work really hard at it. It's what they do. And they deserve your attention for that moment when you're engaged with them. It's really important. It's part of recognizing their humanity and your humanity in the process. The willingness to put the phone down, it was one of the examples at the start of the show. If it's a really important call, excuse yourself, step aside. You can come back, you can rejoin the line when the call's over.
You know, it's interesting, the young people. I wonder if it's like when the recycling movement got started and it was young people who were targeted who then could tell their parents. I mean, I have half-siblings who are teenagers, and they will send me a text. And if they think I'm driving, they'll say, don't text while driving, which isn't something that I would get necessarily from a peer or an older person. But the teenagers, I think, are getting a different message these days.
So I'm going to go 100 years back in time. Emily Post was my great-great-grandmother. We're a five-generation family business at the Emily Post Institute. And one thing that we've noticed from this generational perspective is that manners renew. Every generation finds its own code of conduct that expresses some fundamental values. We've identified some real principles that stay with us over time. Consideration, thinking about others, respecting others, operating from a place of honesty and sincerity. These tend to be principles that they find new expression. The new manners take shape as old manners use their utility. One of my examples of how manners change was about 15, 20 years ago, we got a lot of questions about recycling. My coworker doesn't recycle. Should I talk to them about it? It's really fascinating, and the manners around that have shaken out. And as is often the case, it's the younger generation that will really lead the charge in many ways towards renewing what we think of as core values.
So cell phones are the new recycling.
Perhaps. And boy, although it's so funny that the questions we get about cell phones, they're starting to ossify a little bit. They're starting to be clearer and clearer what the expectations are around cell phone use. Texting has joined the cell phone as part of that conversation. And as you mentioned at the start, Google Glass, the next generation of more integrated biological technologies and technological devices, are going to bring up a whole new set of questions.
Getting a lot of emails and notes from people, calls as well. P.S. says on our Facebook page, my personal rules, one, cell phone is off most of the time. Callers know I'll call them back promptly if they leave a message. Two, cell phone is for on-the-road safety. It's there if I need it. Three, all personal communication is made from home via computer phone, and that includes texting. And four, the only feature I'll use in public is the notepad. If someone gives me information or if I have an idea I don't want to forget. And Rob says, it's no doubt increasingly difficult to control when and where electronic devices are paid attention to more than, say, humans. But one place they're not allowed in our house is at the dinner table. In fact, pretty much all the meals are about eating and community with people actually in the room, not at the other end of the internet. I'm a proponent of using these electronic devices as a tool and an extension of our communal lives. However, there's nothing like being in the same room at the same time. We are talking about electronic etiquette today, digital do's and don'ts, modern manners when it comes to the technology that so many of us have at our fingertips. You can share your thoughts, your experiences. You can vent with us. Call 1-800-639-2211 or post on our Facebook page at facebook.com/Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Today we're talking with Daniel Post-Senning, author of Emily Post's Manners in a Digital World. He's helping us navigate the murky waters of appropriate behavior in a digital world. We've been talking about things like what to do when your friend takes a call in the middle of an intimate conversation you're having over coffee, and how parents set limits at the dinner table. If you have a digital etiquette question or experience of your own that you'd like to share, go ahead and post it on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. You can even talk about Facebook etiquette if you want. Or call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Jim is on the line from Burlington. Hi, Jim. Go right ahead. Oh, one
yes,
second.
Hey.
Yeah, there you are.
This is one of my pet peeves. If I'm out in a restaurant, you know, eating my dinner, somebody on the next table, they pick up their phone, and they start, you know, yelling or raising their voice. What should I do to that person?
Other than glare at them. Dan, what should he do?
Jim, thanks for calling. That's where you want to look for someone who has standing to address the situation. A restaurant, you're going to be able to find somebody who's got the standing. It might be the hostess. It might be your server. It might be the owner of the establishment. But those people work really hard to create a certain atmosphere, a certain ambiance, so that you can enjoy your dinner. And oftentimes I'll hear people ask, well, you know, it's okay with the people that I'm with if I use my phone at the table. I know that, you know, a formal dining I wouldn't, but this is family dinner style, and it's okay with the people I'm with. And I say, well, what about the people at the next table? Could you ask them? What about the server who's working with you that night? Did you ask him. It's really important to think about everybody who's involved, and you're a good example of that.
What if, though, it's not a restaurant that Jim's talking about, but what if he's at a coffee shop where it may be a place that people often do some work and do some reading, or, you know, on a plane, on a bus, in a park?
Great subtlety. So coffee shop, I talk about the one-hour rule. You've got about an hour per beverage that you purchase to use that little mini office for that period of time, and oftentimes coffee shops are environments where cell phones are permitted. Keep an eye open. The origin of the word etiquette is little sign, and the etiquettes around cell phones are very clear. They're popping up. When people want a cell-free zone, they'll put up a little sign that says, no cell phones, please, or please take calls outside. Certainly the case with some of the coffee shops here in Burlington. And I would say always respect and honor that kind of request.
And if it's a place like, for me, it's the planes where you're sitting on the runway, the plane hasn't taken off yet, and people are just shouting about things that I don't really need to know about.
Plane's a captive audience situation. You want to stay off the phone, at least as far as a conversation goes. This is one of the few places where the substitution mentality, maybe a text message is appropriate there, where a phone wouldn't be. You want to get a quick message off to the person that's picking you up, or let someone know that you caught that flight they just dropped you off for. Here, a text message is probably the polite alternative.
Let's go to Joan, who's calling in from Middlebury. Hi, Joan. Go ahead.
Is this me?
Yes, this is you.
Oh, okay. I went to high school in Italy, and what I noticed is that there was a very well-developed politeness in terms of face-to-face communication and so forth. But the Italians had not learned telephone etiquette, so when they would call our house, they would you would answer the phone and they would say, "Who's speaking?" And my father and our family would go through this long ritual of, "You called, please announce yourself, and then, you know, and who do you wish to speak to?" And it took us a while to teach the people that called our house that sort of minimalist phone etiquette. And I think that's what's happening here. It's just that the electronic advances and the advances in communication and so forth have outdistanced, have yet to be caught up with a development of proper etiquette. And that's what we're discussing, really.
Yeah, Joan, thanks for the call. Appreciate that historical perspective. Let's go to Frank, who's on the line from Burlington. Hi, Frank. Go ahead.
Hey, hi. How are you?
Great.
I'm going to probably add more heat than light to the conversation. I just want to share a little piece of etiquette that happened to me, and I had kind of a quip and a comeback for it, too. I think, not long ago, I was sort of standing around on Church Street or something like that and waiting for somebody, and I can't go anywhere because it's, okay, we're going to wait at point X here. And woman walks up, out comes the phone, and she starts making a call, and she's having this sort of real sort of intimate conversation like a foot from me, and I'm sort of looking at her, seeing if she would get it or not, and she looks over to me, and she goes, "This is private." And I had to go, "Well, then have it in private."
Right.
You know? It's in zing, right past her. She just did not get it, and I wonder, we have etiquette things going on. We also have, what's privacy anymore, too? I mean, I'm supposed to walk away in public, you know?
Yeah, Frank, interesting point. That whole privacy question is a huge one. I mean, we were just briefly touching on Google Glass, and if you haven't heard about it, this is this technology Google's coming out with, and right now it's sort of in its beta phase. But it's sort of like glasses, and you have this little device that's attached to your glasses, and it can take photos, it can take video, and you can do it. Well, right now you have to use your hand, but there are ways to do it hands-free by winking or something like that. And it's bringing up all kinds of etiquette questions and privacy questions especially, Dan.
Absolutely. These devices are so powerful. They have the potential to broadcast to billions of people. And they also are all equipped with high definition cameras these days. And the questions that raises about public and private environments and spaces and how we create public and private spaces collectively and individually is really, it's one of the most fascinating areas of this new technology and the behaviors around it. Actually, I heard a great little tip from one of the producers of this show who was talking about anytime you're in a situation where you would excuse yourself to leave, if you feel that accountable to the people that you're with, that's probably a bit of a private situation. You want to be aware that even if you're at a restaurant or you're in a public place, that you're maybe in a private situation before you took a picture or posted a picture from that situation. You might want to check with the people involved. The particular situation you described, the very private conversation happening in a very public place, it's one of the great seductions of cell phones. That person that we're speaking to, they seem so immediate. They're so close. We are often seduced by the illusion of privacy. And I warn people that the place you're likely to be using this device is not a place where you necessarily have that right to privacy or that expectation of the right to privacy.
Well, that's interesting, Dan, because you're sort of talking about a couple things there that
it's
you may
such
not
a
have.
Balance.
Yeah, you may not have an expectation of privacy, and yet you are saying we should also be aware of the privacy of others, so maybe don't take that photo at a restaurant. But, I mean, even before cell phones, people have been taking pictures at restaurants for as long as there have been cameras.
Yes. At the same time, the ability to distribute that picture was very different just 10 years ago. So the idea of getting permission before you engage a real distribution of the photo or a sharing of that photo in a really public way. 15 years ago, if I took a picture before I put it up in a gallery, I would probably ask somebody, if it's for my home photo album, maybe that's still a private space. And there's still some discretion, some latitude that's allowed in my decision making around that process.
So you get engaged at a restaurant. You ask the server to take a photo of you and your special someone. You're then supposed to turn around to anybody else who might be in the picture and say, do you mind if I post this very special picture on my Facebook page?
What a prescient and appropriate question. If I was going to be earning money from it, I would need to get releases from everybody. But if I'm sharing it in a way that's essentially part of my private experience, this was the story of my engagement, then I think you're still operating in the private space where that's okay.
All right, listeners, what do you think? Give us a call at 1-800-639-2211. Let's go to Bella in Rutland. Hi, Bella. Go ahead.
Hi. My questions are about email. I feel like we have so many different platforms to communicate these days that it's hard to know exactly how to get a hold of people. And as a working mother with two little kids, I just find I have so little time to get around to email. I've been trying to keep my email messages really brief, but mm-hmm. I find people don't respond to email, and I don't always respond to other people's email. And it seems as sort of lost conversations that happen on email all the time.
So, Bella, what's your solution? Do you call people or do you just say, well, these relationships are going to fall by the wayside for a few years?
I mean, some of it has been prioritizing for sure. But also, like, I find I have to have this conversation with people a lot now about how shall I reach you, you know? Mm-hmm. Shall I Facebook message you? Should I call your landline? Should I call your cell phone? Should I call your work phone? Send a text. That everybody kind of has their own platform, which just makes it a lot more complicated to communicate, especially with groups of people these days.
Yeah, Bella, you're certainly right about that. Boy, how do you reach people when there are so many different possibilities? And Dan, do we just have to ask people now? What's the best way? Do I tweet you?
It really is. It's such a foundational question when you're establishing a relationship. How do we stay in touch? And I like to flip the question on its head a little bit and ask people, how do you want to be reached? And really think about that, because everybody is faced with so many choices. Figuring out ways that are easy for other people is one of the ways to be a good networker, a good communicator today. Email in particular is still the major communication medium for business. It's fantastic for businesses because there's a chain, there's a record. This is another place where for businesses, it's great because that record belongs to the business. For the individual, being aware that that's not a private communication medium is really important. A lot of people get into some trouble that way. Businesses are trying to often keep people from doing too much business via private mediums like texting or instant messaging, where there isn't a record of the communication that everybody involved is accountable to. So,
although didn't we see what I think I'm remembering this correctly, even now in presidential, in the president's case, texts are on the record now, too.
Texts are on the record, although you don't always have as easy access to them as a person in business, because the texts are often paid for by the individual. They belong to the individual, even if you could subpoena, blah, blah, blah. it is a detailed and rich environment, although I love the idea of just jumping back to the phone call. When communication becomes tense or strained, when that volume of email gets difficult, when you're not at inbox zero and you feel that you're just at sea and you're getting behind, the idea that you can pick up the phone, resort to a different medium to reestablish communication is a great option to have in your toolbox.
We got a note from Sean who says, I only have two rules. One, no cell phone when at the checkout counter or when interacting with anyone helping or serving me. And two, you should not check your phone or read your phone when in a conversation with someone. Jerry Seinfeld once said you wouldn't pull out a magazine and start reading it in mid-conversation. That would be rude. So why do people think it's okay to start texting or checking email while we're talking to each other? Charlie says, smartphones can be used for so many things these days. I use mine hiking as part of the Vermont Atlas of Life Citizen Science Project. Some find that odd, but I don't see it as any different than using a field notebook to take notes or a camera to take pictures. Yes, there are also times to put away all distractions and just be in the woods. But I find I'm more attentive to my environment, smartphone and all, than those rushing past me to get to the top of a peak. To each their own. And Robert says on our Facebook page, a recent suggestion seen online. While having dinner, everyone at the table places their cell phones and other electronic devices on the table. The first person to look at messages or to answer a call pays the bill. Nothing worse than having a conversation with someone and they pull up messages. Someone might call that multitasking. I call it plain rudeness. And let's go to Richard in Lindenville. Hi, Richard. Go ahead.
Hi. I had a couple of one comment and one question. The first one was, I remember when I was young, this goes back a ways, and my father and sometimes my mother would take me to New York City and we'd do the museums and all those various things. And when you were in the city and you didn't live in the city, you'd sometimes see as a small child things that shocked you. And one of them was the number of homeless and schizophrenic people on the streets talking to themselves. And the thing that amazes me from my childhood memory is how much we resemble that now. As a normal course of operation, we're always talking to ourselves through these machines. But the imagined world, not much different from the real one. But what I want to know is why we get so offended at the use of cell phones in public places when, if we're talking face-to-face, we know to tune out conversations. But if I'm talking on a cell phone at the exact same volume and same tone, that can be construed somehow as rude or inappropriate.
Yeah, good question, Richard, because, you know, if we're having conversations all over the place, Dan, what's the difference between having a one-sided conversation on a cell phone or, you know, having to listen to two people having a conversation together?
So I have a couple of thoughts in response to that, and this is a great probing question. The first is that when you're hearing a conversation between two people, you have both sides of it. And when you hear a conversation on a cell phone, you're only getting one half of the conversation. And believe it or not, there's some precognitive sorting of sound that happens in our minds. It actually happens out closer to the ear. And when you've got that intact conversation, you can actually reduce it and put it away. But when you've just got half of the information, your brain instantly starts a process of filling in the other. It's harder to ignore. People, when talking on their cell phones, many people don't know that you don't hear your own voice back in the earpiece the way you do on old landline phones. So when people are new to their cell phones, they'll often increase their volume because they're not hearing themselves as well as they're in public spaces or places where they're distracted. So, but why does this bother us? There's another idea. When children are going through developmental stages, they have a stage of parallel play and a stage of cooperative play. In the parallel play stage, I've got my dump truck and you've got your dump truck, and we each sit there and play with our dump trucks. And when we're cooperative play, I maybe fill my dump truck up with sand to pass it to you, and you empty it and pass it back to me empty. And it's a developmental stage that we go through. It's a more advanced kind of play. And I see people on their cell phones, and it reminds me of parallel play. And to me, the importance of human interaction, the engagement with the people that you're with as part of living a healthy, fulfilled, rich life is really important. There's a concept, vagal tone. The vagus nerve connects your brain and your heart. And like a muscle, you exercise it and it atrophies if you don't use it. Scientists can measure vagal tone. It's a biological indicator. Your vagal tone, the degree to which your brain regulates your heart, indicates things like how well you hear tone of voice from someone. And literally, the process of interacting face-to-face improves vagal tone, the subtle biological interactions that occur between two people who are physically present with each other actually make you healthier and equip you in rich ways to interact with other people. So the phone doesn't strip us of these things, but if it reduces the amount of time that we spend practicing, we actually lose capacity. So when I talk to parents, I say it's really important that you put your phone down when you're holding your child. Almost the most important thing that you can do for raising children is to actually give them that quality human interaction that's really important to their biological development.
So this idea, you know, Richard talking about why is it so annoying to have to listen to people having a one-sided conversation? It's more than just oral voyeurism. You know, there's actually something going on in our brains.
And then maybe that's level one, but we just dove down through about three levels. And on a really fundamental level, the ability to interact in a really rich, dynamic way with the people we're physically with is so, so important.
There are a couple other places that we haven't addressed. We talked a little bit about offices. We've talked about, you know, semi-private spaces, public spaces, but there are just a couple I want you to touch on. One that I've noticed, now if you go to the doctor's office and they're using electronic medical records, I've had doctors say, I'm so sorry I'm not looking at you face-to-face. I can't figure out this stupid electronic stuff that I'm supposed to do, and I have to put it all in now. And there seems like there's some difficulty now in a space like that with somebody who has to use digital technology but is finding that it's more difficult to have face-to-face conversations.
When is it a tool and when is it a crutch? And it really so much depends on how we use it. A doctor that's so reliant that their bedside manner disappears obviously becomes less functional as a working professional. It's definitely a lesson that we can all take to heart, because to some degree we're all faced with that question.
And what about schools? What's the responsibility of a school to either model good behavior or to set rules? I mean, there are parents who want their kids to have certain rules, and schools are trying to navigate mm-hmm. all that while also setting their own.
I like to think of schools as the place of work for kids. It's a great model or parallel. And just like I would advise any good company or workplace to have a social media policy, it's really important that schools have social media policies, and that it's not just a document that's at the back of the HR manual or the student handbook, but that it's something that breathes and lives, something that's part of a discussion in the classroom. And that might be a computer science or IT class, or it might be a social studies and history class where you're talking about the history of communication. But a willingness for teachers and administrators to engage the social media policy that really should be on the books is important to start to bring it to life in a way that's meaningful for everyone.
Daniel Post-Senning is the author of Emily Post's Manners in a Digital World, Living Well Online. He works at the Emily Post Institute in Burlington. Dan, thank you so much for having this conversation with us.
It's my pleasure to be here.
We're still getting a lot of great emails, Facebook posts from all of you, tweets. Kelsey in Waterbury Center says, as a longtime member of the service industry, etiquette is part of my job. Even the most experienced server makes mistakes now and then, as do children. And by having an expensive piece of equipment on the table alongside water, wine, sauce, and oils does not equate for me. When approaching a table with a hot plate slowly burning in my hand, it's an additional effort to have to avoid the expensive technology on the table while placing a plate. It would be much appreciated by many members of the service industry if the phones and tablets stayed in the pocket or purse, something we didn't even think about. Please keep those notes, experiences, vents coming. Go to our Facebook page, facebook.com/Vermont Edition. Add your thoughts, add your rules, carry on the conversation. And coming up, we're going to focus on two laws addressing gender and sexuality in insurance benefits. You're listening to Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Last week, the Department of Financial Regulation issued a bulletin reminding insurance companies not to exclude coverage for medically necessary treatment for transgender people. That includes gender reassignment surgery. Susan Donegan is commissioner of the Department of Financial Regulation. She's on the line with us now. Hi, Susan.
Good afternoon.
So the Vermont legislature passed a bill in 2007 that prohibited discrimination on the basis of gender identity. Why is this bulletin that your department put out necessary 6 years later?
Well, let me first tell you that a bulletin is a way that we communicate with our regulated insurance companies. It's the way we send messages about clarifying our positions and policies, and we do many types of bulletins. A recent one, people might remember, Tropical Storm Irene. Well, we sent a message to the insurance companies telling them how to handle claims during Irene. So this is something we do a lot. And it was timely to update the bulletin that was issued in 2007 based on gender identity discrimination for a couple of reasons. First, we were preparing here at the department to enter the new world of the health insurance exchange. And so the department's job was to look at health insurance plans and coverage and make sure that we understood what the exclusions and the benefits were going to be for the new health insurance exchange plans. So that was number one. We wanted to look at what benefits were out there. We also got some calls from consumers or policyholders over the last year that were not clear if their health insurance covered their gender dysphoria or gender-related health care or health transition surgery. So we had to explain various benefits to consumers, and that also helped us to understand that there have been some significant medical advances in the understanding and treatment of gender dysphoria, and we wanted to make sure that the insurance companies were also keeping current.
I understand, Commissioner, that you're suggesting that people actually carry this bulletin with them, though, if they have questions for medical health professionals or their insurance companies on what is required and what is allowed under the law?
It's always good to be an empowered consumer. And if this bulletin helps to explain to doctors as well as insurance carriers of what is to be properly covered, then I think that that's a very good development.
Were you finding that insurance companies were confused? I mean, were there problems, lawsuits, difficulties that you'd actually been seeing around this law?
That was not brought to our attention here at the department, although we had several calls from consumers that they themselves were confused about whether their own health insurance covered these types of procedures. And one of the reasons is that there's confusion is that if you're covered by what's called an ERISA, employer self-funded plan, that's a special kind of coverage that preempts state law, and the plan, the employer, can decide what kind of benefits they wish to put into their plan. And many employers had been excluding gender identity related conditions. So the first thing we were telling folks is, gee, you've got to call your employer to see whether or not you're in this kind of coverage where your employer can have the latitude to say we're not covering that. If you're not in that kind of plan, then you are in a plan that would not be able to reject a medically necessary process, procedure, medical care, and that it should be covered by your insurance.
So just to clarify here, the law, it does not apply to companies that have their own self-funded insurance plan. So theoretically, these companies can still discriminate on the basis of gender identity or sexual orientation?
Yes, if they are the ERISA, the federal plans, if they wish to. Now, we hope that will change someday with not only DOMA, but also we're going to see some changes once the health exchange start, because under the Affordable Care Act, we know that there is to be no discrimination based on gender for programs and medical procedures as well as the health exchange that are funded through federal ACA funding. So we're making great progress even on the federal side.
I'm talking with Susan Donegan, Commissioner of the Department of Financial Regulation, about a bulletin her department issued last week reminding insurance companies that they cannot exclude coverage for medically necessary treatment for transgender people. And Commissioner Donegan, I guess that's the real question here too, is how do you define medically necessary treatment? I mean, some treatment for gender reassignment, for example, could otherwise be considered elective procedures like breast augmentation. So how is medically necessary defined?
Well, we have a regulation that guides us in terms of what is legally medically necessary. But I'll tell you, I'm not a doctor, and thank goodness, but you would want a medical person, a doctor, to do the full evaluation based on the current science about what is medically necessary for a particular condition and for a particular patient. So I can give you an example of what would be an interesting way to look at this. If I needed a hysterectomy because I had cancer, I think we could all imagine that a doctor would find that medically necessary. We wouldn't have to have a big conversation about that. If I was a female who was going to transition to a male, and I went through testosterone treatments for, say, 10 years. We now know, because of medical advances, that testosterone, a powerful drug unto itself, can promote and put a patient into a higher risk for cancer. And so I, as a female-to-male transgendered person, would say to my doctor, what are the kinds of health things I need to think about? And the doctor would say, well, it would become medically necessary at some point if you're going to need to stay on testosterone because you're going to be in a high-risk category for cancer, that we would need to do a hysterectomy, and that would be medically necessary. So what we look at is here in insurance is that it should not matter what the origin of the need for hysterectomy is. If a doctor says it's medically necessary, whether it's cancer or whether it's cancer or it's the threat of cancer because of testosterone, it's medically necessary.
We just have a couple seconds left, but I want to ask you to address one other piece of legislation that was recently passed, awaiting the governor's signature. And this bill has to do with out-of-state employers discriminating against same-sex couples living in Vermont. whether they have a civil union or a marriage. What does this law do exactly in brief?
This law gives equal access for same-sex spouses to family insurance benefits offered by employers, just as to heterosexually married partners in Vermont. And it changes the insurance law to make sure that there's no distinction between parties to a civil union or married same-sex couples and married opposite-sex couples. It also does another very important thing. It closes the loophole for sexual orientation and gender identity discrimination in employment practices, something that had been overlooked in the labor side, the employment side of the law. So we now bring that into sync with our insurance laws. And most importantly, we now are once again a strong leader in civil rights and good regulatory practices against discrimination for Vermonters.
Susan Donegan is Commissioner of the Department of Financial Regulation. She's been talking about regulations in Vermont that require insurance companies to cover necessary medical treatment for transgender people. And we also looked at a new rule requiring out-of-state companies to cover same-sex partners living in Vermont. Commissioner Donegan, thanks very much.
My pleasure.
That will do it for today's show. Tomorrow, your reactions to the end-of-life bill that will become law in Vermont. The legislature passed it, and Governor Shumlin says he will sign it, making Vermont the fourth state to approve the practice that supporters call death with dignity and opponents call physician-assisted suicide. Send your thoughts and reactions to VermontEdition@vpr.net and join us tomorrow at noon. Our producers are Patty Daniels, Rick Singeri, and Sage Van Wing. We have production assistance from Tim Johnson. Mary Williams directed the program, and our executive producer is John Van Hoosen. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.